very happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me. And that was actually a great introduction because you brought up kind of almost the instantaneous question that comes to people's mind when I describe my research, and hopefully by the end convince you that it is a very intriguing topic that hopefully has a lot of therapeutic implications for the future. We know that cancer and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are all diseases for which we lack very effective therapies and which we don't understand all that well. So we'll see here. Okay. I really don't have any disclosures yet. Hopefully I won't have too many. I don't know how that works. Okay. So you may wonder, why are we here on this Friday morning talking about a link between cancer and neurodegeneration? And just out of interest, has anyone ever heard in their entire medical career of a link between the two types of diseases? Just raise your hand. Okay, so it's a kind of a novel concept. At first glance, it might seem a bit bizarre. Cancer, as Becky was saying, is a disease of uncontrolled cell growth. And neurodegeneration is cells inappropriately dying early. So you could think of them as opposites that might not have too much to do with each other. But what I'm hoping to show you over the course of this talk is that they have an awful lot to do with each other. And the basic science connections that explain that may also explain why we tend to see an inverse relationship in human studies, in epidemiologic studies. So we'll be talking about that. And we'll be doing some review, going back in time to some basic science things. So I've tried to put this together knowing this is a mixed audience. Hopefully your eyes won't glaze over at any point when we do the basic science stuff. And it's an interesting topic because it really does unite many different scientific approaches to understanding a problem that we really don't know much about. So people first started noticing a link between cancer and neurodegeneration at least as far back as 1954, when Dr. Doshay wrote an article about Parkinson's disease in JAMA. And one thing he noted from his long clinical experience was that cancer is exceedingly rare in paralysis agitans. So he had a very kind of impressive clinical experience with patients with Parkinson's, and one thing he just noted was that they hardly ever got cancer. So it's a little unusual to think about negative or inverse relationships between diseases. We're very common, you know, we think about positive ones all the time. We can think in terms of cancer and other diseases. We've got pancreatic cancer has a positive association with diabetes. Just about, you know, if you look at cancer in general, if you're a cancer survivor, you have a much higher risk of stroke than someone who's never had cancer. Same with cardiovascular disease. And this is not just because of complications of recurrence of cancer, this is because of shared risk factors. So there are a lot of positive associations between cancer and other medical diseases. But a negative one is really a strange bird. There are a lot of negative associations that we make much of and we get excited about because we're trying to cure disease or prevent disease. So some of the more famous ones, especially around here in the Framingham study, the inverse relationship between HDL and cardiovascular disease. Okay, so the higher your HDL, the lower your risk of cardiovascular disease. And then on the bottom right, can you see this well? Do we need to like dim the lights, or you can see this okay?
It's all right.
You're all right? Okay. Here, this isn't showing up all that well, but basically it's a graph of alcohol intake and cardiovascular disease. You can see that the relative risk is significantly lower in men who are regular users of alcohol. So negative associations. One thing protects you from another. Okay, so is it possible that one disease, like let's say cancer, if you survive it, somehow protects you from developing another disease? That's certainly what the epidemiologic data would suggest, although we'll talk about the possibility of other explanations for that relationship. So who cares about this? Well, we should all care about anything that has to do with cancer and neurodegenerative disease in the elderly, since it's so prevalent, and over time it will become more and more prevalent. When we think about predicting what percentage of our population will get one disease or the other, how one getting one disease influences your risk of another, those things are very significant. But I think the more interesting thing and the more potentially helpful thing for people in the future will be to understand why. Why should there be a negative or inverse relationship between these two diseases? And what can we understand about diseases through investigating this? And is it possible that if we can somehow capture what it is about cancer that protects you from Alzheimer's disease, if we can somehow understand that and create a drug that would somehow do the same thing, would it be possible that we could find a cure? So that's ultimately where my interest lies. So what we're going to do today is review the epidemiologic evidence for an inverse relation between cancer and neurodegeneration. I'm an epidemiologist, so that's my main contribution to this, although now getting into translational stuff, and I'll talk a little bit about that. I'm going to help you understand the biological pathways that are common to both processes, and then finally give you one example of a link that could explain an inverse relation between cancer and Alzheimer's disease, a protein called PIN1. So first let me talk about epidemiology. Doshe in the 1950s noticed just anecdotally this inverse relationship between Parkinson's disease and cancer. And the first really big epidemiologic study to look at this, and you need a really big one because Parkinson's is a fairly rare disease. It affects men twice as much as women, so in women it's very rare compared to, let's say, Alzheimer's disease. So this is a study out of Denmark that basically showed that most cancer types, for most cancer types, there was an inverse relationship between Parkinson's, having Parkinson's, and getting cancer. So these are 14,000 patients with Parkinson's disease. That's a huge number, right? You can only do that in a national database. They compared them to people without Parkinson's, and these are the relative risks. So, and these cancers are your basic epithelial cancers, also leukemia, lymphoma. So the bulk of non-skin cancers are here. And then which are the ones for which there's an increased risk? Very few. Melanoma is the most remarkable one, malignant melanoma. This is breast cancer, but in men, so it's hard to say what to make of this here. Other skin cancer, so really it's skin cancer that stands out as having a positive association in these patients. A little bit brain here. And then in women, it's melanoma, and again, breast cancer, other skin cancers, and brain. So, and then down here, I think this is kidney, but it's a very minimal increase. So what this, the whole overall picture is telling us is that for most cancers, having Parkinson's disease is somehow protective. For a very few, there's an increased risk. It's a very unusual cancer pattern to be associated with, I mean, with anything. That's very interesting. And he also did another study. So these are patients who have a diagnosis of Parkinson's. So you could think, well, maybe it's something about the treatment of Parkinson's that would be putting them at risk. So he did another study looking at people before they got Parkinson's. So these are people who followed their whole lives in Denmark, right? So they looked at, in people who developed Parkinson's, looking backwards over time, what was their cancer risk? Same kind of picture. For most cancers, lower risk. For melanoma and perhaps breast cancer, higher risk. Okay. So I did a number of studies in the Physician's Health Study, which is a very small data set to be looking at this question. We have 21,000 people. But I was able to show evidence of an inverse relationship there, both before and after the diagnosis of Parkinson's. And I got together with some colleagues and we did a meta-analysis of 29 studies looking at this question. We tried to take out melanoma, knowing that was kind of a different issue. But in any case, the bottom line is if you put all the 29 studies together, the chance of getting cancer, if you have a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, it's a relative risk of 0.69. So it's very significant. You know, obviously, when you add all the studies together, you get more significance. Somehow, some kind of protective effect of the diagnosis of Parkinson's. Again, protecting you from most cancers, but not all. And the one that kind of stands out, I won't show you too much of this, these are just our numbers, and I'll just point out a couple things. One is that if you look at all studies together, we use their random effects, you have a risk ratio of 0.73. When we excluded skin cancer when possible, knowing that that's kind of acts in a different direction and probably a different mechanism, the risk ratios went down even further. For smoking-related cancer, you see a more substantial protective effect than, you see a more substantial protective effect against smoking-related than smoking, than non-smoking. And that's not surprising because you probably know people with Parkinson's disease tend not to be smokers, since smoking somehow protects against the disease, another strange inverse association. But in any case, in both smoking and non-smoking cancers, there's this protective effect. I call it protective with quotes, of course. The one cancer for which there's really no question that people with Parkinson's are at increased risk is malignant melanoma. And that's also very interesting because the only two pigmented cells in our body besides the retina are melanocytes in the skin and the neurons in the substantia nigra, which are affected in Parkinson's disease. So there are all kinds of, I just reviewed a review article looking at potential mechanisms to explain this connection. It's very interesting. That probably doesn't have much to do with whatever the protective effect is going on in all of these other cancers, but it's a very interesting focus of research right now. We really don't know the explanation. So if we move on to, so we can say in summary about Parkinson's that there's really, quite convincing evidence at this point of an interesting cancer pattern where, aside from a few, perhaps breast and definitely melanoma, aside from a few cancers, there's really a protective picture going on. It also, I should say that, we've looked at treatment a lot of time, for a long time people thought L-DOPA treatment was a risk factor for melanoma, that somehow that was causing or driving melanoma. But if you look at people who, as I said before, get the disease before, I'm sorry, if you look at cancers before diagnosis, okay, of Parkinson's, so before treatment, the risk of melanoma is the same. It's increased both before and after diagnosis. So it's hard to say that treatment of Parkinson's has anything to do with it. Okay, so Alzheimer's disease. There's a lot less information about this. I have a career development award looking at this right now. It's all kind of a novel idea, let's put it that way. There's a little bit of autopsy evidence that people at autopsy who have Alzheimer's disease, on autopsy, have fewer cancers than people who don't have Alzheimer's disease. So that's interesting. Another study, which is fascinating, is a study of an ongoing, longitudinal study of Japanese survivors of the atomic bomb. And so they are a group at increased risk of cancer, obviously, because of the radiation. And those who survived cancer and continue to be followed in the study had a very significantly decreased risk of Alzheimer's. Their risk was decreased about 70%. So again, very interesting finding in this unusual cohort of people who had an increased risk of cancer. And obviously then just looking at the survivors. And then there's only been two prospective studies so far looking at cancer and Alzheimer's risk. And you probably can't see that this too well, but it's okay because generally they're very simple Kaplan-Meier plots. And this was a study that Rowe and colleagues did back 5 years ago now. And they used an Alzheimer's Disease Research Center cohort, just like you have here. And so these are people who have enrolled in the study to be followed over time. Some of them have Alzheimer's, some of them are controlled. And they just look to see, in this case, if you had, so in the beginning, a follow-up, you either had Alzheimer's or you didn't, and they follow people over time to see who developed cancer faster. And the solid line is people with Alzheimer's, and the dashed line is people without, okay, so no dementia. Now, what's an obvious criticism of a study like this? Anything pop to mind? You're going to doubt the findings or give an alternative explanation besides some kind of protective effect. Yes?
We were hypothesizing back here that maybe it's because
Right.
Like, so most of our patients have all different doctor part. I'm just taking doctor parts for this thing. Yeah. They don't get mammograms, or we don't.
That's right. Right, exactly. And that was my criticism of the study as well. It's not just the study, it's kind of a problem. It's hard to get around, right? People who have severe cognitive impairment are much less likely, we know this, to have screening for disease. They might be less likely to complain of symptoms. They're less likely to get a serious workup to get a real answer on what's going on. So all of that could explain something like this. So for me, this approach was not really attractive in trying to understand the problem. This one made much more sense. Here you're starting with everyone who, nobody has Alzheimer's, so everyone is about the same in terms of their cognitive function. They have normal cognitive function, basically, for their age. And then you're following them over time to see who develops Alzheimer's. Okay. So the solid line, people who have survived cancer, cancer survivors, and people who have never had cancer, and you can see here how much more likely they are to develop Alzheimer's. Now, in this study, they didn't have the numbers to really look at this issue. They had so few people in this arm of the study, or this approach, that their findings were not statistically significant, but they were suggestive of a protective effect. So they went on and did another study in a larger cohort called the Cardiovascular Health Study that many of you have probably heard of, similar to a Framingham study. And so they had bigger numbers. They followed people for a fairly long time, and they did the same thing, except instead of incident cancer among people with dementia, they looked at hospitalization for cancer, and they felt that that was going to be a more objective thing when you're comparing demented and non-demented patients versus incidents, as you were pointing out. Obviously, there are plenty of reasons why the demented population would not have their cancers that are there detected. So that was their approach to trying to go a little deeper into this question of, is this all just detection bias, or is this truly some kind of a protective effect? So that was pretty clever. Then they had people with and without cancer and time to dementia. So it's the same idea. And this is really interesting. Here, looking at time to first cancer hospitalization in people with and without Alzheimer's or dementia. They had lots of different types of dementia. We'll show you the difference here. So what you're seeing is in pure AD, so this is people who have AD and no vascular dementia, no other condition contributing to the dementia. You can see that the hazard ratio of being hospitalized for cancer was 0.31, so very, very low compared to people without dementia, okay? Then as you start mixing in other cases, for example, people who have both vascular and AD, any dementia, and then as you kind of look at pure vascular dementia, you can see that actually the protective effect is less and less, to the point that there seems to be a non-significant increased risk of cancer in patients with vascular dementia. So I just want to show you that difference here. As you have the pure AD, there seems to be this kind of remarkable protective effect. Any dementia, you have less of a chance. So you're getting more and more cases of other types of dementia. And then when you look purely at a completely different type of dementia, has really nothing to do with the same pathophysiology, you don't see that. So it's interesting. Again, you can poke holes in this and you can doubt it, but it was a very interesting finding. They did then the opposite, looking at people with and without a history of cancer going forward, and you can see that people with a history of cancer had a risk ratio of 0.57 for developing Alzheimer's disease. So similar results to their first study, a little more convincing. The problem is that their dementia was very well defined. very well, just like it's defined here in your ADC or in Framingham. But cancer was not well defined at all. So that was a weakness. And they really didn't do anything to address the mortality bias that you picked up right away. So that's where I decided to do my own study. So I've been working with folks at the Framingham, Phil Wolf, who's on your faculty in neurology, and Alexa Beiser, biostatistics. We've been working together on this. And we basically, so Framingham defined a dementia cohort back in 1975. It's an amazing study how old it is. And so they've been following these people who were cognitively normal in 1975 and then just kind of seeing what happened. So everything is so precisely, beautifully defined. It's really a unique kind of data set that way. Same thing with cancer. So people, anyone who has cancer, it all gets picked up. It all gets confirmed. So we started at exam 20 when they measured ApoE and a couple of other important things you want to adjust for in any analysis of Alzheimer's disease. And I decided to start with people who are 75 and older. And the reason was because Alzheimer's, as you know, is a disease really of much later life, whereas cancer is a disease of, you know, kind of all of life, but certainly you would never say most cancers are diagnosed, you know, after 75. Perhaps you could say some of them. I mean, not more than half, let's say. Whereas with Alzheimer's, that's not the case. So anyway, I decided to kind of look, knowing I have very small numbers to work with, to look at people 75 and older, history of cancer, no cancer, outcome, development of dementia, or AD. So same thing they did in the other cohorts. So this is just showing the characteristics. We had 130 people who had a history of cancer, normal cognitive function, 525 without history of cancer, again, normal cognitive function, beginning of this observation period. The major difference that I see here is that ApoE was not, there was 25%, so ApoE4, 25% in people who had a history of cancer, and 18% in people without. Other than that, things looked fairly similar. More men had a history of cancer than women, which makes sense also. Okay. So what you can see here, this is cumulative incidence of probable AD, so the most strict definition of AD, by whether or not you had non-skin cancer at baseline. I looked at different things because I was thinking I might see something similar to Parkinson's disease. I did skin cancer separately and non-skin cancer separately. So here's non-skin cancer. These are people who've never had non-skin cancer, and these are people who had non-skin cancer at the beginning of the observation period, and you can see how much lower their incidence of probable AD is than the non-cancer survivors. Then we did the other approach where we took every case, the incident case of AD in the cohort, and we matched them at the time of their diagnosis with four controls who did not have AD. Nobody had a history of cancer. Okay, so this is a kind of a case cohort approach, case control, but looking forward. And you can see that people without AD had a higher incidence of non-skin cancer than those with AD. Okay, so we're seeing the exact same thing in reverse, very similar risk ratio estimates. So now I'll show you some of those. So history of cancer at the beginning of the observation period, and then the risk of incident dementia. So here's the risk of any dementia, 0.62. And as you go down to kind of refining your definition from possible to probable AD, you see a kind of, again, this decrease in the risk, or the increase in the protective effect when you're looking at pure Alzheimer's disease compared to any dementia. And in this cohort, for whatever reason, there's not that many cases of vascular dementia. So So at least compared to the other cohort I showed you. So the kind of dilution effect is not as dramatic. And we didn't even have enough cases of vascular to look at them as a separate category. Okay, I just wanted to show you that breast cancer seems to be going in the opposite direction as the other non-skin cancers, similar to what you see in Parkinson's disease. Don't ask me why. If you take the breast cancer cases out, you get an even lower risk ratio. I didn't have enough cases to really present them as a separate column, but so that's why I did it this way. And then skin cancer seems to be just doing a completely different thing. It's not increasing the risk in a statistically significant way, but it clearly does not have, there's no protective effect. I didn't have enough cases to take melanoma out because, of course, melanoma is a very different disease than the other skin cancers. So those are some of my limitations. Additional adjustment for APOE education and homocysteine level really did not change significantly the effect. Okay, so then I just said, well, what can I do to convince people this is not all due to survival bias? So one survival bias we didn't talk about, we talked about the detection bias of disease in people with cognitive impairment or dementia. The other obvious bias would be survival bias. If you have a history of cancer, you're much more likely to die than somebody who doesn't, right? So maybe the reason you don't get Alzheimer's is because you're dead, or you're that's about it. You're not around to get Alzheimer's. Okay, so this is a very clear criticism or an obvious, you know, thing that you should be concerned about that wasn't really addressed in the other studies. So I wanted to try to address it. These things are very difficult to completely address. But I said, well, let's look at people who lived, okay? Only people who lived for 10 years after our baseline. We're taking the dead people out of it on both sides. If this was an effect of survival bias, what should happen? Really, the effect should go away. The protective effect should be, you know, at least cut down significantly if this is a significant contributor here. So we did that, and you can see that it really had absolutely no effect on, you lose some significance because your numbers are going down when you do a sensitivity analysis like this. But basically, I mean, this is even a lower relative risk than over here, where we fully adjusted for everything in the other model with everybody in. Okay, so does that make sense? So it's a way of saying, okay, well, this isn't perfect, but if we only look at people who lived, the cancer survivors and the non-cancer survivors, do we still see this effect? And the answer is yes. And then I did another thing, which was to say, well, let me look at another outcome. Not another outcome, but another exposure. So we looked at people who had, another outcome. So cancer, they all had cancer exam 20, same people, okay, with and without cancer. But instead of looking for Alzheimer's, we were looking for stroke, okay? So if this was just an effect of survival and you had a bad history of cancer and that was going to decrease your risk of any late onset disease, you should see the same pattern in every late onset disease that you look at, right? So we would see the same thing with stroke. We would see the same thing with MI or whatever we wanted to look at. So here you can see that in people who we're looking for any stroke in people with and without a history of cancer, and you can see that there's a very significant increased risk, 1.70 for people with all cancer, non-skin cancer, non-skin, non-breast, and skin. Okay, so kind of across the board, if you've had a history of cancer, your risk of stroke is increased. So we're not seeing the same pattern. So that, to me, that was also kind of a convincing thing to get at this. Then we did it in survivors. Well, let's be complete, and we'll look at people who live for 10 years, and you see the same thing here, that it didn't change. So it makes you think, this is a real association, this is real, and the other two are real as well. Okay. Then finally I did the reverse analysis, even though I don't put much stock in this because of the problems we already described, which are that people with Alzheimer's disease at the beginning are less likely to be diagnosed with cancer. I think that's always going to be true. You can try to adjust for it. But there may be some evidence that it doesn't explain everything. Again, you see this, what am I trying to show you here? That the risk ratios go down again as you look at probable, the most pure form of AD compared to other types. But I would never use this as evidence for. I think here that the best thing you can do is compare it to another type of dementia, like vascular dementia, which was done in the other study, where they did not see these decreased risk. The risk was actually increased. Okay, and then if you include everybody from 65 plus, which is our whole data, you see the same thing, but it's the effect is not as impressive. Because you're kind of diluting everything by including a large period of time where people are highly at risk for cancer but not highly at risk for AD. Okay, so now I'm moving on. So that was the, that's my own work and what led me into this whole project. But ultimately, the reason I was fascinated by this is because there's definitely something going on that needs to be understood. And that could potentially push us forward in terms of treating both diseases. So if you think about it, what could link cancer and let's say Alzheimer's disease? Well, one possibility is that different individuals have different apoptotic response pathways. One person might have a very vigorous one, and another one not so vigorous. The same goes for other cell survival pathways. We always think of P53, right? That's the policeman in the cell that tells you whether you're going to live or die, depending on how bad your mutations are. So it's possible, certainly, that a gene that would, or a mutation that would confer a more vigorous apoptotic response would protect you from cancer, but put you at higher risk of neurodegeneration, which is ultimately a disease of inappropriate apoptosis. So it turns out that almost all of the genes that are associated with Parkinson's disease, the PARC genes, you know, PARC1, PARC2, I think there's 10 of them, most of them function either as a tumor suppressor gene or an oncogene in cancer. Okay. So there's this, they have dual roles. They have roles in protein processing and folding and roles in the cell cycle. And that's true for AD as well. The one protein that we know of that kind of links AD and cancer has a dual identity. It does many things, but it is critical for protein folding, and it's critical for the cell cycle. In fact, a cell cannot divide without it. So if we think for a second about the difference between neurons and peripheral cells, it's kind of an interesting thing. Might not have thought about it lately, if ever. But the whole purpose of a neuron is to establish connections with its neighbors and maintain those connections for as long as you live. And hopefully those connections remain functional so that, you know, you have good cognition. The thought of dividing for a neuron is just anathema, right? Why would you ever want to do that? If you went and divided yourself, you'd mess up all your connections. So that is why neurons cannot divide. And everybody always tells me, yeah, but there's lots of brain tumors, you know, out there. You're right. But none of them are from neurons in the adult. They're glioblastomas or astrocytomas, right? They're supportive cells. They're lymphomas. The neuron cannot divide. Can't. All it can do is die. So that's very different from peripheral cells, which have to divide at least sometime during their life in order to keep things going, right? So in both cases, the cells need to have very tight control over the cell cycle. In the case of the neuron, it's got to be kind of off permanently. In the case of the peripheral cell, because it does need to divide sometimes, it's very tightly controlled when it divides and how much it divides. Okay, so this is just to show you that many of the PARC genes have roles in cancer, but we're going to switch on to... Oh, and then another big... connection between Parkinson's and cancer. I don't know if you're familiar with the drugs called protease inhibitors. They're very kind of new, flashy drugs that we use to treat multiple myeloma and some other diseases now. They block they mess up the ubiquitin proteasome system, which is a system in the cell to help degrade proteins that you don't need. And in cancer, this UPS system is upregulated, and it's part of, you know, what gives cancer its energy. So these drugs block that. Okay. In Parkinson's disease, the UPS is not upregulated, it's dysfunctional. So if you block it, you can cause Parkinson's disease. So thank God, in clinically, proteasome inhibitors don't cause Parkinson's, at least not so far. But they have the potential to do that, and you can induce Parkinson's in mice giving these drugs. So here again is a clear explanation of an inverse relationship between the two diseases. Okay. Now I'm going to move on in the last few minutes to PIN1, which is a protein that was discovered at the Beth Israel and in our department. When I was a fellow, I got to know the investigator who discovered this, and that's how I kind of got interested in this whole line of work. PIN1 is a really cool enzyme that its job is to act on other proteins and twist them into different shapes. So it can take a protein that has all of its, basically around proline, right, this amino acid, proline has a really kind of unique ability to flip from a cis to a trans orientation, if you remember back to organic chemistry, that was painful. Anyway, remember that one of the things you're supposed to take away from that course was this idea of flipping around a bond, and it turns out that that's a really important mechanism for protein regulation, turning enzymes on and off, turning genes on and off, that kind of thing. Okay, so PIN1 catalyzes this reaction whereby proteins flip around a bond, turning an enzyme from an active enzyme to a non-active enzyme, for example. Okay, so we've said most of this. It turns out that PIN1 is really crucial for many important signaling processes in the cell, and helps really to control the cell cycle, kind of the ultimate one, cell response to stress, and interestingly, neuronal differentiation and survival. So it's kind of really right in the middle of both cancer and Alzheimer's disease. And if everything's going well and it's working, what it does is it tends to renew protein. So a protein like tau, which you know is one of the two proteins that are dysfunctional in AD, tau and beta amyloid, what PIN1 does is, so what happens is tau gets phosphorylated just as part of like the daily grind in the cell. When it's phosphorylated, it's less likely to work. It goes into its cis conformation, and that's actually the pathological one in Alzheimer's disease. PIN1 comes around and it flips it back to trans, and then it can be dephosphorylated and go back to work. So PIN1 is constantly recycling tau back to its working form. In beta amyloid, it turns out that PIN1 is crucial in the processing of amyloid precursor protein so that it's processed in a way that doesn't create the bad beta amyloid. Okay, so if PIN1 is not around, you end up getting the amyloidogenic beta amyloid, which causes the plaques. If PIN1's around, it prevents that by renewing, again, the healthy form of the APP. So I hope that makes sense. If PIN1 is upregulated too much, if it's cranked up in the cell, you get cancer. If it's absent or very low, you get Alzheimer's disease. And I say that because we do it in mice. That's the evidence. Also, if you look at the brains of patients, human patients with Alzheimer's, you find very low PIN1 levels. If you look at tumors, you find very high PIN1 levels. So there's very good evidence now that this is playing a role linking these two diseases. Just to remind you, without making your eyes glaze over, of the cell cycle, what happens is you get mitogenic stimuli. They might be good ones because the cell is supposed to divide. Like if it's in the lining of your gut and you know it's supposed to be renewing your gut all the time. Or they could be bad ones. In the case of cancer or Alzheimer's disease, you have inappropriate signals that they're being given tells the cell to go into the cell cycle. Okay, so it comes out of the G0, remember that, it's kind of sleeping, just hanging out, goes into the cell cycle. And it's got to make it through many different checkpoints. And what these checkpoints are looking for are mutations that have, you know, kind of occurred over time. In a normal cell that does divide, in order to get through these checkpoints, it can't have any mutations. It's really very strict. In a cell like the neuron that is never planning on dividing, the neuron doesn't waste a lot of time fixing mutations that and things that it's never going to use. So it accumulates an awful lot of mutations. And that's okay, because it's never going to divide. And these are not in things it needs to use. In a normal situation, you go through all of your different stages, you double your genetic material, and you go ahead and divide at the end, and that's great. In cancer, this happens inappropriately. When cells that have no business dividing, divide. When cells that have all kinds of mutations somehow escape the checkpoints and are released from the controls that should be there to keep them from dividing. In neurons, it turns out, in AD and also PD, that the neurons, the degenerating neurons, are trying to divide. Okay, we've already said that should never happen, they shouldn't try to divide, but they do. And there are mitogenic signals, and this is happening early on in the course of Alzheimer's, not late. And they get these signals, they try to go into the cell cycle, because they're full of mutations, bad stuff starts happening right away, there's all this DNA damage, P53 says we can't have this, and it starts deciding to do apoptosis. There are plenty of other things going on, but the bottom line is, at a certain point, there's an arrest of the cell cycle, it cannot continue, and it dies. Okay. So here we have a cell that is trying to become a cancer, in a sense, right? It's trying to inappropriately complete the cell cycle, it cannot, and so it dies. So that's, again, another link between cancer and neurodegeneration. I already explained this to you. And PIN1 helps you maintain a healthy neuron by renewing APP and tau into their functional form, by flipping them back to their functional form. If it's not around, you get overproduction of the bad APP. You get overproduction of the bad beta amyloid and plaques. You get dysfunctional tau that forms those tangles, and Alzheimer's disease. These are the hippocampus, samples of the hippocampus. You can see low PIN1 here, and cells with neurofibrillary tangles, so ones affected by the Alzheimer's, and high PIN1 in cells without neurofibrillary tangles. So again, very clear evidence there. This is just to show you that there are a number of mouse models that we've been using to study Alzheimer's disease for many years. The only mouse model that can provide both the plaques and the tangles at the same time without a lot of gyrations is the PIN1 knockout. So it's really an exciting discovery because it, for the first time, linked the two kind of pathological proteins. PIN1 deficient mice will develop. So it's not lethal, but they have an early aging phenotype. So here's the little old mouse and the normal mouse. And the little old mouse has all of these findings that we associate with aging. So that's interesting. If you overexpress PIN1 in the brains of mice that are kind of programmed to develop tauopathies, so tau problems, then you can make them recede. So basically you're able to, if PIN1 is active, you're able to renew the tau, fix it, and the disease is arrested or improves. In terms of cancer, PIN1 works in many different ways to promote cell division. So if it's inappropriately overactive, it's like a triple whammy in terms of pushing ahead cell division inappropriately. These are all the different tumor types, and you can see how PIN1 is overexpressed in almost all of them. So it cuts across many different cancer types. finally, if you could look, think about pin one activity, we want to have it, you know, be regulated perfectly. With aging, its activity goes down naturally, but not sharply. In Alzheimer's disease, in the brain, its activity goes down sharply, and you develop the phenotype of Alzheimer's. In cancer, its activity goes up sharply, and you develop cancer. So in terms of, I'm going to end now because I know you might have a few questions, but the therapeutic implications of this are pretty clear. We already have PIN1 inhibitors, which could be very useful in treating almost every kind of cancer. And we are developing now PIN1 stimulators that could be helpful in treating Alzheimer's disease. And in mouse models, if you knock in an extra copy of a gene or you do something to, you know, increase PIN1 activity that you can't do in a human, unfortunately, you can basically cause Alzheimer's to regress. And you can cause a tumor to shrink very dramatically by inhibiting PIN1. So in summary, epidemiologic evidence suggests this inverse relationship between cancer and neurodegenerative diseases of aging. You know, I don't know how much I've convinced you. It's really difficult. There's a lot of potential biases in interpreting data in elderly patients who have so much competing risk and all of that. But that's, we got to do the best we can. The only thing left to do is some kind of very complicated Markov-type model of, I don't know, I know what has to be done, but I have no way of doing it to convince, I know, people that this isn't all just survival bias, but in any case, the relation is very plausible based on basic science evidence. And I do think that a deeper understanding of these pathways, which we keep finding more all the time, that could potentially explain a link between them, could really lead to new therapeutic approaches. So I'd like to thank all the people who helped me make this research possible. I'm in the process of looking at PIN1 as a biomarker for Alzheimer's disease and cancer, and I collaborate with people here at the BUADC, and Ping Liu is the one who discovered PIN1. There's a whole lab devoted to that. I work with him, and these are my other mentors. So thanks for your attention, and I'm happy to take any